Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. In computer software and media, and film, television, an Easter egg is an intentional inside joke, a hidden message or image, or maybe secret feature that a lot of people do not pick up on. Creative types like to put Easter eggs in their product to have fans ooh and ah and giggle when they recognize something or see something, or there's a reference to something that only they get, or maybe they and their friends get, and they can't wait to share. It's kind of an intentional nod, nod, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more. Here at the Gentlemen Nerds, we've decided that since we are fast approaching the holiday of Easter, it would be a great time to talk about Easter eggs in media and software and computers and movies and TV, video games, you name it. Boy, there's so many of them out there, and I think we're going to have a good time exposing some that maybe you guys out there don't know, or maybe some that are your favorites. So we're here, we've got our drinks, we've got our Easter egg baskets, we're ready to collect some eggs. Sitting at the table, as always, is Mark Finn.
Excelsior, true believers.
Aaron DiArrive.
Excellent. Oh, come on, I know, that was lame. No,
that was exceptional. And I am your host and emotional touchstone, Joseph Fotinos. Welcome to the Gentlemen Nerds Easter Egg Special.
Hey, hi guys. Good to see you. Real quick survey. Chocolate rabbits, do you bite the head or the ass first?
You bite the ears. That way you could fill it with milk and then drink the chocolate.
I have always loved you.
I do. I have to admit, I do bite the ears. That's the first thing. The first thing to go.
Yeah.
And but Pete. Peeps, you have to eat their eyes so they don't see what's coming next.
Oh, Jesus. Especially when you put them in the microwave. That's just,
all kinds.
Yeah, peeps are meant to be put in a microwave.
This got dark early. We got so dark so early.
Had I thought about this any more, because I've been so kind of obsessed with the idea of like discovering some of my favorite Easter eggs and getting ready to share them, I would have thought about a much better opening and would have tried my best to do Vincent Price as Egghead from the Batman 66.
Oh, my God. You did a good little bit there. Excellent.
All right, so guys, let's get into this. I'm very excited. I proposed this topic, and I thought of it the weekend of Easter last year. And so I've been kind of sitting on it for a year because, you know, you can only do this once, and you can only do it the week before Easter, or otherwise you're just goofy, you know. I'm curious. What was your, like, just like taking it out of movies and taking just like, what was the first reference while consuming something else that you guys remember? What do you have a memory of, like, what your earliest one was?
I remember seeing one, but not knowing about it until, you know, years later. And I'm referring to the probably most well-known, or one of the most well-known amongst people our age, Easter eggs of hiding an R2-D2 in the mothership in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
People kept pointing out, there he is, look, see, he's hanging upside down. You can see him right there. And of course, at the time when I was a kid watching it, I missed it completely. I didn't know that there was But that's what the first time I remember, like, oh gosh, you know, they've been doing this kind of stuff, you know, since the 70s. Of course, obviously, it's gone even before then with Alfred Hitchcock making appearances in movies and various directors putting little tidbits into their films. But that's when I remember that's when I became aware of sort of a thing that Lucas and Spielberg would do back and forth with their movies. That's when I remember.
Okay.
I remember a sound. I remember a distinct sound that I would consider one of my first Easter eggs that I would pick out in movies. And that's the infamous Wilhelm scream.
Yes.
The sound that was, I think, classically boiled into my head as a stormtrooper fell down a shaft in the Death Star after being shot by Princess Leia when they're about to do the swing over the chasm. She shoots him. He falls. He goes, ah! He makes this very distinct noise as he's falling. And that's the Wilhelm scream. And it was taken from an old, I think it was a 1950s or 60s African adventure film where a guy gets eaten by crocodiles in this river. And that's the sound he makes.
It got the name from the 3D film from 1953, The Charge at Feather River, starring Guy Madison. Uh-huh. And it's specifically named for Private Wilhelm, who's in the movie. And it's labeled Private Wilhelm gets shot in the back with an arrow. He falls off his horse it is a crocodile killing. It ended up on Haunted House Records. It was a really distinctive thing.
Yeah.
And it's still being done today.
I mean, it's still being done movie after movie after movie
because of the Wilhelm animated screen. Series. Yeah, it's always it's in that public domain library of sound effects that people grab. And at this point, they do it intentionally. If they're using the Wilhelm, they know it's going to be recognized.
That's right.
You know,
yeah. That's right. It's the how do you do for audio visual nerds. and then the call and response is fine. How are you? You know,
that's right. Yeah.
All right, that's cool.
Film,
I appreciate that.
One last bit. You simply talking about sound effects and screams and sounds in the movie Son of Frankenstein from 1939, Boris Karloff's last performance as the Frankenstein monster. There's a scene where he discovers Igor's body. He's not really dead, but anyway, Igor's body on the lab floor, and it was his friend. Karloff does this great emotional buildup, and he lets out this scream of agony after finding his one and only friend shot on the lab floor. That sound, his scream, Universal loved it so much, they took it. And they used Karloff's scream in a lot of different movies.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. In fact, they used it in another Universal horror film when Daniel in House of Frankenstein gets tossed off the castle roof and slides down. His scream is Karloff's scream.
That's so cool. I had no idea. All right, hold on. The gentleman rules, gentleman nerds rule, if you get stumped, you have to take a drink. So here we go.
Oh, okay. Well, here we go.
We are starting early.
Okay. Mark, what do you got?
I have an audio one as well. And this was very intentional. Records. For those of you kids that don't know, what you call vinyl, we used to call records or albums, were made as a physical object with grooves that allowed the sound vibrations to transmit. There was this phenomenon in the 70s called the FlexiDisc, and it was a gimmick. You could actually print a record on a thin sheet of vinyl acetate. Mad Magazine included them. Sometimes they were included on the back of cereal boxes. Alphabets and Honeycombs would have records that you could cut out, and you had to put a quarter on a certain point of the record to keep it on the turntable.
I remember those. Yeah,
but there was a Mad Flexi Disc called Super Spectacular Day. And what was cool about it was they call it the Mad Mystery Record. And this came out in 79. They had already done some things with hidden tracks and backward masking and things like that. But they figured out that physically you could like stop the groove on a record and then start it again. And so depending on it's hard to understand the spatial configurations, but this was a little tiny jingle that had eight different endings to the song. Mm-hmm. They play the first part of the song, and it was basically this kind of just kind of silly thing that I had stuck in my head for years. It's a great big beautiful, wonderful, spectacular, or wonderful, incredible, super spectacular day. It's just kind of goofy thing, but then the whole thing is, you know, everything's going great, and then some guy would go until, and then the next part of it would kick in, and it'd be this horrible situation, whether it was relatives or a blind date or aliens come down and grab you or whatever. And the ending would always be something and something and something each A, that it's not such a super spectacular day. Very Mad Magazine. Well, they told you on the cover that it was a surprise ending. And I just assumed that they made 8 different versions, right? Like, you know, here's the thing. But where the needle hit on the record would play a different ending. So, you know, I'm playing this on my turntable and it's kind of fun. And so, like every kid my age, I wanted to memorize this in case something happened to the record, you know, because that's what I did. I memorized movies and anything that I liked, I would commit to memory. Ironic now that I can't tell you what my cell phone number is, but that's neither here nor there. So I start playing it, and it's playing and it's playing and it's playing, and all of a sudden I hit a different ending. Well, this is sorcery to me, you know. This was witchcraft. I didn't understand it, you know. It was just it was fantastic, and it was such a surprise, and I didn't even know there were 8 versions, because of just basically it was kind of dumb luck as to how the needle would hit and go into the next groove as to what ending you got. You had no control over it. So, of course, the internet solved this problem by eventually somebody digitized all 8 versions and you play them back to back. And after 8 times of listening to it, it wears thin. But as a kid, it was just, you know, it was a typical Mad thing. You know, what I came to recognize is a kind of a very George Costanza kind of a thing. You know, a horrible thing after a horrible thing happens, and it's not just a super spectacular day. Yeah. It was very, you know, very New York kind of Jewish deli, but I can't complain sort of a thing. Anyways, that was the first time that I encountered something like that, and it just blew my, like, what else have I been missing? I went and listened to every other record. This has to be somewhere else. Just in case, yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is how the whole play the records backward thing got started. People like Mark was running around going, "Hey, I wonder if I missed something cool," and then of course it became Satan is speaking to me. Yeah,
or in this case it was Al Feldstein of Mad Magazine.
That's right. You know? Yeah. Buried Paul.
Yeah, sweet. Yeah. Well, Satan by any other name is still Satan.
That's
filmmakers have a lot of fun in movies doing these types of things, and obviously sometimes they're passing along a personal message either to the audience or to another co-creator or filmmaker or friend. One of my favorites in that genre or category of Easter eggs is the very friendly, happy, I don't say rivalry, but the back and forth between Wes Craven and Sam Raimi.
Yes.
They communicate to each other through film, or the late Wes Craven and Sam Raimi. Of course, it all started back in 1977 in the film Wes Craven's The Hills Have Eyes. There's a torn up poster of a shark in the Carter family's camper, and most people thought it was a Jaws poster, which I think it kind of was intended to be a Jaws poster, but I don't think it was an official Jaws poster. It was a big great white shark that was kind of torn in half, and a lot of times people say, oh, you know, Craven did that on purpose, obviously, to say Jaws wasn't that scary. Look at this is going to be scary. It's the way for him to go, you want horror? Hills Have Eyes, watch this.
Right.
So in Evil Dead, the original Evil Dead, Sam Raimi kind of returned the favor, just took a shot at him, and there's a Hills Have Eyes poster hanging in the cellar of the original Evil Dead, and it's torn in half, as if to say, hey, that's not scary. This is scary. So Wes Craven says, oh, really? And he fires back in the original 1984 A Nightmare on Elm Street, where Nancy is watching a film on TV as she's trying to stay awake, and it's the Evil Dead. Right. Ironically, Nancy's having a hard time staying awake watching The Evil Dead and is falling asleep. So there's a less little nod there as well. Sam Raimi says, oh, okay, and in Evil Dead 2, Freddy Krueger's iconic glove is hanging in the cellar of Evil Dead 2. It's seen twice in nice. Frame, hanging in the cellar. Wes Craven was like, oh, okay, well, we can keep going. Years later, he did Scream in the 90s. And, of course, Scream is full of Easter eggs and references to other horror movies. But Randy, yeah. the character played by Jamie Kennedy, hosts a party, and he's got films to choose from. He asks the guys, what do you want to see? And, of course, he's got Evil Dead is one of the films that he's asking people, do you want to see it? But they end up watching Halloween instead.
I would go so far as to call Scream, almost a meta movie, regard.
Yeah, very much.
No, but the speaking back and forth continues to this day, strangely. Whereas Wes Craven passed away, unfortunately, but Starz has a series, Ash vs. Evil Dead, and they keep that tradition alive. And in season one, the finale of season one, Ash goes back to that same cabin in the woods, and guess, wouldn't you know it, yes, that Freddy Krueger glove still hanging up in the fruit cellar. And then in season two, Ash goes back in time to 1982, and a movie theater is glimpsed in the background, and outside there's a poster hanging, and yep, The Hills Have Eyes.
I love it. That's nice. Tremendous. And I think a very nice tribute. You know what I mean? Like,
because
a lot of times that's what they would do. I mean, and that's what the whole thing back with Spielberg and Lucas, they knew each other, and whether it was a friendship, like in the case of Lucas and Spielberg, or a friendly rivalry or something like that. That's what it is. It's the creators of this media sort of winking at each other and doing, you know, hey, did you see that? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And it's a lot of fun.
Joe Dante was also very famous for putting movies and movie posters in the background of his stuff. And and I would even go so far as to say, because I feel, you know, a lot of this stuff that came out of the 70s, of course, we have to mention that the first video game Easter egg that anybody remembers was the gray dot in Adventure, the Atari cartridge.
Oh yeah.
By the way, as a trivia on that, you know that because the reason this started happening is because the companies didn't give credits to the programmers. Programmers were not allowed to have credits in their games because they were afraid that the employees would be poached by other companies. And so the programmer started saying, well, screw you. I'm going to put my name in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that was really the origin of all of that. But yeah, I'm sorry, Mark. I don't know. Yeah.
I was just thinking about Salem's Lot, which was a TV mm-hmm. movie that I did not like, but it was full of these kinds of references and nods. And, you know, Stephen King was one of these guys that was not afraid to drop in the culture that informed his work. You know, he never even filed the serial numbers off. He would just reference old mm-hmm. monster movies. And of course, the two scenes in Salem's Lot that I like and hate. Well, the only scary scene in the movie, as far as I'm concerned, is the scene where the kid's trying to get back in to get Jimmy. And Jimmy breaks the cross off of his Aurora model kit.
And it was an Aurora model kit that I've never seen. That was invented for the film. That doesn't exist. They pieced together some model kits. The Dracula is there. I think the Frankenstein. This is from Monsters of the Movies. It wasn't the big ones. There were the Monsters of the Movies kits.
But the of course, his kid's room is just
Easter
in heaven. Yeah, totally.
And of course, Salem's Lot is his, you know, Stephen King has said so. It's his Dracula. He loved Dracula and wanted to do Dracula. So he decided to write this. And so, of course, I mean, there had to be a reference to the classic Dracula. So remind me, the model kit that he tears the cross off, mm-hmm. is that Dracula?
It doesn't exist. There's no
model. No, I mean, but who does it feature? Who's in
it's,
that?
It's a graveyard scene, and it's got a guy cowering, like pulling back with his arm up in the air, what I think is a doctored version of the Frankenstein from Monsters of the Movies, because he's got that same position. His arm is up like that. But it's like a villager or somebody cowering back. And then Dracula, the actual monsters from the movies, Dracula is there, but he's worked into a different background, and there's a graveyard set. There was never a graveyard set in these model kits. So
I went looking for the kit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't find it. And that's when I realized, oh, he put this together. Bastard. But the other thing was, of course, the way that they designed the vampire in Salem's Lot was was an intentional nod to Nosferatu. Yep. And it's a shame that it was a TV movie and they were hampered by budgetary concerns because it didn't work. But as soon as I saw it, I realized what it was. I mean, I was a monster kid, so I knew that you were trying to do Orlok. I just didn't know why he was blue. And I didn't know why he was in such bright light. I mean, that whole thing would have worked way better if he pulled him into the shadow and all you saw were the eyes or the silhouette or something else. I mean, you know, rodents don't like the light. And the whole point is that he's a rat faced kind of, you know, that's what he's supposed to be. But
and that's strictly from the show, by the way. In the novel, Barlow is not like that. He's nothing like that.
That's right. And so
he speaks, he's eloquent. He's a lot more like Dracula. And so who did the, was that who, Joe Dante? Who did the
Santa Claus? Toby Hooper.
So that was a decision by the filmmakers. I don't know if Toby Hooper specifically said, hey, I want this guy to look like Nosferatu.
I think they were looking for a little bit more, you know, because it was a movie on TV. So they looked a little bit more sensational, visual. They gave basically all of Barlow's lines from the novel to Stryker in the TV show. Stryker says all the great lines that Barlow has in the novel.
Yeah. And it was, and I remember, you know, not just the confusion, but also just kind of like, I remember being indignant. Like, you had this great shot, you had this great opportunity and you blew it. You know, you could have, you know, I'm Al Pacino. I gave you a shot and you blew it. Oh God, you know, why? So sometimes the Easter eggs backfire. Most of the time, I would say 95% of the time, you know, we take them in the spirit in which they're offered, which is a love note. You know, it's a little nod to us, a way for. Oh, I think they have become in the age of DVDs where you can now stop a movie on a frame.
Yeah.
You know, and especially in film where as soon as the movie comes out, there's guys with lists. They become signifiers like we got this, you know, we know what we're doing, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. You know, I mean, I mean, for a while, Stanley appearing in the movies that Marvel made was great, but it wasn't necessarily a harbinger of quality. You know,
I don't know if I would put cameos with Easter eggs. Are they two separate things?
Well, they are. I actually consider them separate things. Yes.
Yeah.
It's only in that Hitchcock.
Oh, hold on. Unless there are cameos like we have seen in the last two new Star Wars movies, where Daniel Craig is playing the stormtrooper that what's her face is mind controlling. That is an Easter egg because you don't know that it's Daniel Craig.
Exactly.
And they cut it, but Tom Hardy plays a stormtrooper who is looking at John Boyega's character and going, who would have thought you would have made captain? Again, those are Easter eggs.
Yeah.
So Glenn Close in Hook, playing the pirate crewmate that betrays Captain Hook would be
if you do not, you know, Alfred Hitchcock walking in. Oh, look, it's Alfred Hitchcock. You know,
that's the thing.
Oh, look, it's Stan Lee.
Prior to the Marvel Cinematic Age, I think the only people that knew Stan Lee were comic book people. Whereas Hitchcock was Hitchcock, you know, when he started doing his cameos over here in America, everybody knew him. And in this case, I think Stan is, you can't count Stan as an Easter egg because we now look for him.
Right. The one Stan Lee cameo that I would look at and go, that's kind of a thing, I guess. It's not just Stan Lee walking in as the delivery guy, is from Guardians 2 when he's talking with the Watchers. And, yeah. And he's going through all the things he's done, and he's kind of nodding to us saying, yeah, that was me. It was the same character every single time. And then I was a UPS guy, you know? It's a weird blending of, hey, it's Stan Lee, and oh, no, it's something else, and this character's talking to the Watchers now. And who is this? What is going on here?
I love that they worked that in. The fact that he is explaining to the Watchers that he's appeared in these other movies, it raises it. It's no longer now just, oh, look, Stan Lee's making a cameo. Like you said, they've worked him into the mythology of the movie. Like, what's going on? Who is Stan Lee? You know,
Again, there's a point that, you know, I think the Easter eggs work as long until you get meta, you know, like because the Easter egg should be the thing that only you should note it in passing or whatever. But if it drops you out of the movie, because I mean, I had to watch Scream, an example of Scream. I had to watch Scream twice. Because the first time through, I kept getting thrown out and going, oh my God, this is an essay where he takes his work apart. You know, and when it hit me, I was like, oh God, why am I not writing this down? You know, and so it's the same thing, you know.
Well, Scream, I mean, like you said, full of Easter eggs. One of my favorites in Scream, in addition to the one I talked about with the VHS tape of Evil Dead, was the janitor, is Wes Craven. Dressed up in Freddy Krueger's sweater and hat.
I love it.
It's the janitor. And I was like, there's Wes Craven.
I'm happy laughing, you know, because it's just like, for literally my entire, like, teenage and adult life, I've been pointing at the screen and going, oh, when no one else was, you know.
Yeah.
I have to share with you, you know, one of the joys and frustrations of my life is owning a movie theater in Vernon, Texas. We have had the privilege, and I would say social responsibility, of showing every Marvel movie. We literally opened the year before Iron Man came out. So, like, boom, all of them. Technically, Spider-Man 3 was our first one, but we're not going to count that.
Nobody counts that.
Nobody counts that, but
oh God, yeah, nobody counts Spider-Man 3. Yeah,
I remember watching Iron Man with the same sort of hopeful, well, let's see what they do, okay, you know, kind of thing. This is with an Elektra movie on the table and a Ghost Rider movie and a Fantastic Four movie and all this. I'm watching Iron Man, and I knew we were going to be okay. When I saw Tony Stark in the casino and he's rolling dice, and in the background, I can hear a jazzy big band playing, and I went, oh, they get it. get it. For those of you that don't know,
that is the Iron Man cartoon theme
from 1966.
That's right. Yep.
By the way, it's also his ringtone. It's also the ringtone of the Rhodes's character. His phone rings and it's da 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 da. Yep.
Well, you know, okay, guys, since we're launching into Marvel, I mean, Marvel is like full. I mean, it's bursting at the seams with Easter eggs. We can't go through every single one of them, but we mention a few. So let's round robin it. Let's talk about our favorite Marvel Easter eggs. I'll launch it off. The Incredible Hulk 2008. They are two students, and their names are – they're interviewed in the news about having seen the Hulk, and their names are Jack McGee and Jim Wilson.
Yes.
Jack McGee, the reference to, of course, Mr. McGee, the journalist who tracked down Bruce Banner in the Hulk in the TV series, and Jim Wilson, the name of that young boy orphan who becomes the Hulk's friend in the comics. And that's pretty – it's deep stuff, but it's not that deep. I mean, you can figure that one out, okay? You guys, next.
I'll do the next one. Captain America, the first Avenger, I really like the fact that they made an effort to recreate on stage Cap punching out Hitler as a reference to the comic book cover. Now, of course, they show you the comic book cover in the movie, but I like the fact that they went ahead and included it because I think that's now more than ever, a really important piece of mythology that we have to always keep in mind. But that was, it was just a really nice affectionate nod to Simon and Kirby you know, doing it before anybody else really did it. And also of the fact that this was the first Captain America media project out of many that actually made the effort to set it in World War freaking II. Yeah. So
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Aaron, what you got?
You know, mine is cheating because somebody had pointed this out to me. They knew one of my pets who passed away several years ago, his name was Finn. He was a little Scotty, very cute. And what people would always be amused was like, oh, Finn, like, so, you know, like the Gaelic name. And I'm like, no, actually he's named after Finn Fang Foom, the famous Marvel dragon character that wears the purple pants. And so they were like, oh, okay. Most people didn't know who the hell Finn Fang Foom was. Well, someone pointed out that in one of the, I think it's the Iron Man movie, there is a scene that Iron Man is zooming by a street scene, and on a poster, you can see Finn Fang Foom.
Oh, wow.
In Iron Man, the 2008 Iron Man. And again, somebody, I did not see this when I was watching the movie. Someone pointed it out later and said, you know that, right? Finn Fang Foom is in Iron Man. I'm like, no, he's not. Like, yeah, he is. And that's so awesome. I got on YouTube and I looked it up and I was like, oh my God, Finn Fang Foom. So again, it's so quick. No one will ever catch it. Few people even know who Finn Fang Foom is, but I think that's cool.
That is pretty cool. Absolutely. That's pretty cool. The collector in the Guardians of the Galaxy film, his museum is just an overwhelming, eye-popping Easter egg extravaganza. It's like the kid in a candy store. One of my favorites, not only Cosmo the Space Dog and Howard the Duck, but the slug creatures from James Gunn's film Slither are in the collectors. Nice. Yes.
Super deep cut. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. A deep cut.
I like that one. In the Avengers, I didn't catch this initially because it goes by sort of zip like that. But in the Avengers movie, when Thor grabs Loki off of the Quinjet and they go land on the mountaintop to have their cool little scene, two ravens go flying off.
Yeah. Hugin and Munin.
Yes.
Hugin and Munin, man.
And it took me, you know, I watched it three times before somebody said, so did you see the ravens? What ravens are you talking about? This isn't a Teen Titans movie. And they went, no. Odin's raven. Oh, my God. And I looked in there, and it's very obvious once you see it, but it was like, oh, that's really cool. Because, you know, because we literally, of course, you know, Loki's the setup at the end of Thor. I mean, it was literally like a one-off. It was perfect. I loved it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Talk about setups. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, and I was just going to mention the other one I really liked was in Captain America, the First Avenger, when they're at the, you know, the World's Fair, the science mm-hmm. thing they go to. They have the original Human Torch costume on a mannequin in a glass tube that he's got a bright red jumpsuit. He's in this little tube thing. And that is a reference to the very original Human Torch who appeared in Timely Comics. So,
yes. And not only that, that specific staging was taken from the comic book Marvels, which was written by Kurt Busiek and painted by Alex Ross. Yes. Marvels was the comic that catapulted Alex Ross to stardom. Mm. And of course, Marvels is the story of the Marvel Universe from the eyes of the common man. And so this is this reporter that works at the Bugle. It starts in at this time period in World War II, and it's him at the pavilion and they're looking at the android in the glass case as it bursts into flame and then gets snuffed out. And so he's talking about, yeah, like, I wonder what this means for the world. And of course, future issues of the comic showed us, you know, when Galactus shows up and stuff. But anyways, that specific capsule scene was Alex Ross's introduction to the Human Torch and the golden age of Marvel Comics, which was really cool.
And can I say, I'm actually disappointed that because of, and I do think it's going to be because of Aquaman and casting Momoa as Aquaman, I'm sort of disappointed that we're likely never going to get a Namor movie. Mm-hmm. Or Namor appearing in You know, I had a little bit of hope for the Fantastic Four that he might show up there because that's kind of where he really belongs. But
yeah, sure.
I think Momoa stole that thunder, man. Momoa looks like Namor should look.
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, I just don't think it's going to happen. And I've always liked Namor. I thought Namor was a great character.
Submariner's big fun. And unfortunately, there may yet be hope, depending on how the corporate pendulum swings. Mm-hmm. If Fox gets to stay Fox, even under Disney rule, they may try the Fantastic Four one last time, but I'm ready for it to lie quiet for a while, and maybe when everything restarts, we'll get another swing at this because they've tried three times, and they just keep shoehorning Dr. Doom into the Fantastic Four's cockpit.
Yeah, and that needs to stop. That absolutely needs to stop. Yeah.
I just want a good Doom. I just want them to do Doom.
I know.
You know what? I don't even need to see the Fantastic Four. Just have Doom just show up randomly.
Yeah, but I think Doom is one of those guys like the Green Goblin. Okay, so you have Spider-Man and you have the Green Goblin, and then that's it. That's done. Any new Spider-Man movie that Marvel does is not going to have the Green Goblin. And I think Doom is sort of the same way, sadly, because like you, Dr. Doom is a classic, man. He's a fantastic villain. But no, you know, give us villains like Marvel, give us villains like the Vulture. You know, wow, what a great job you did on the Vulture. So there are so many Fantastic Four villains that they could introduce.
Doom is so crucial to the universe. I mean, he stands alone as one of the most powerful beings in the Marvel universe. And
synthesis of magic and technology.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, a leader of his own country.
Anti Iron Man, you know, in a way.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think we're going to, you know, they'll definitely, Fantastic Four will go to the negative zone. We might see a Nihilus. We might see, you know, an actual Galactus as opposed to whatever the cloud thing was in the movie. But I really don't think they're going to retread Doom.
We said that about Spider-Man. We thought we're never going to see Spider-Man in a Marvel movie. And then
Spider-Man, notice I would be willing to bet money they're not going to put the Green Goblin in a Marvel Spider-Man movie. Because it's been done.
There's rumors of Kraven and Mysterio being the villains.
That'd be fantastic. And that's what you need to do. When you have these superheroes that have decades worth of issues, they develop a villain roster that you don't want to keep. It's like me and Lex Luthor. Like, no more. If I never ever see Lex Luthor in a Superman movie, I will be perfectly happy. We do not need Lex Luthor. Let's bring in some other freaking villains. And so I feel the same way about Green Goblin. I feel the same way about Doom.
A lot of these Easter eggs that Marvel likes to do is setting the stage. Spider-Man. Matt Gargan, the Scorpion, is introduced in Spider-Man Homecoming. He doesn't wear the costume. He doesn't have the tail, but by God, he's got a little scorpion tattoo on his neck, and he's got the name, so we know who it is.
Yeah,
you know, really love.
I have a controversial proposal to make. And it's merely a proposal. It kind of piggybacks on an ongoing conversation that I've been having with friend and fellow writer Ailey Martinez for a couple of years now, especially in the age that we're in, where we have seen 18 Marvel movies, each one with a secondary or tertiary story that continues from film to film. Mm-hmm. And eventually the tertiary becomes the secondary and then becomes the primary, right? They've done this twice now, and we're going to get it a third time. It was very interesting results, I think. Is it okay to stop calling them Easter eggs? And do we now just consider that to be part of the Marvel marketing plan?
In a way, here's an example, Doctor Strange. just a quick call out, which people were speculating. I don't even know if it's going to happen or not, but we know that Captain Marvel is on her way. Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. Sure. And Doctor Strange, as he speeds down the highway, talking to his assistant on the phone, she tells him about a case, an upcoming case, a young woman struck by lightning. And is that Captain Marvel? Are they doing more of an earthly origin versus extraterrestrial? Is there a blend there? That's the level that Marvel's got us all looking. It's like every line, what did that mean? Was that a reference to something? Oh, who's that? What? This had to be something. Couldn't just be a random woman struck by lightning. There had to be something, you know?
Right.
Like in Thor, when Dr. Selvig?
Selvig, yeah.
Yeah, is talking about, oh, this guy who was a pioneer in gamma radiation. Doesn't call him out by name, but we know who he's talking about.
Sure.
Right. I consider those things like Easter eggs, you know.
They are, but you know what? I actually agree with Mark. And the reason why I think it's important for the Easter egg to be, you know, identified as something that's outside of the movie that has nothing to do, you know, the famous example is Toy Story and The Shining. You know, if you look at Toy Story and you understand how much the makers of Toy Story really love The Shining, that's an Easter egg, because Toy Story and The Shining have nothing to do with each other, except that they like The Shining. So, you know, you see the pattern of the carpet in Toy Story. You see the room number. And that to me is an Easter egg. Or going back to one, I was going to talk another classic one. And this one I did see when I saw the movie, because I saw the movie several times. In the original Tron, there is a little Pac-Man that is sitting there, you know, eating his little pills as Sark is looking at a display screen, telling them to, find him or whatever after Tron escapes. You know, that again, yes, it's a movie about video games, and yes, the guy made video games, but the fact that there's a little Pac-Man there with Sark looking at this display, you know, that to me is the Easter egg. You know, R2-D2 on the mothership is an Easter egg, because they don't really have anything to do with one another.
What about the alien head on the ship of the Predator in Predator 2, the skull of the alien?
See, that's a thing where, you know,
they were blended the universes, but it was still kind of an Easter egg.
I think it is
an Easter egg, but
it's possible in 1987. That someone could watch Predator and not have seen Alien and wouldn't know what that was, right? I mean, it's possible.
I think they're still connecting universes, right? The other example is in the Senate scene in one of the prequels, the ET aliens are there. They have a little pod and they're jumping up and down and such. And I think, again, yes, that's clearly an Easter egg. Oh, look, there's ET. But the idea, of course, being that, why wouldn't the ETs be part of, you know, this galactic Senate if they also came from a galaxy far, far away? So I don't know. I mean, when Marvel does it, it's marketing. I will absolutely think that is, yes, it's an Easter egg, but it's designed to further the Marvel mythology and that kind of stuff. There's nothing wrong with that.
They're making the universe into this grand thing, which I always enjoy.
But the Easter eggs you point out, Joseph, you know, the shark poster torn in half, you know, that those to me are the moments of like, those are the creators having fun, winking at each other.
Absolutely. Well, I also think that, of course, you know, when a lot of this stuff was being done, I give you a great example. R2 and 3PO in the hieroglyphics in the Well of Souls, right? We're talking about guys who worked on stuff for months, at the exclusion of all other things. This is back when you had to build everything practically. And so, I can see in a moment of boredom, it's the same way as when the Disney animators start drawing horrible things in the background, you get a little stir crazy.
And
I know that, you know, R2 and 3PO are on the wall, and when, you know, they couldn't wait for Spielberg to get on set and go, look what we did. And Spielberg goes, oh, very funny, guys. You know, that's probably not even going to be in the shot. And they go, yeah, we know. We just wanted to, you know, and then of course they frame it such. So it's, you know, even clear, you know, you have to look really hard to see it, and you have to freeze frame it. I mean, like, mm-hmm. it's, you know, it, yeah, it was supposed to be a passing thing. And so, so that sort of, I agree that those Easter eggs still can and do exist. And I think should, I think both to communicate to fans and also fellow professionals, I think that's marvelous.
I think my favorite Easter eggs are audio, are words, are character names, or, you know, as opposed to being direct. I guess what you're saying, Aaron, about like the whole Marvel thing, and it's all building blocks to a certain thing. They're just opening up doors to the different parts of the universe, whereas opposed to a true Easter egg is, wow, that has nothing to do with anything in here, but it's a reference to a film that is so not this film, right?
Right now, right.
The Howling, Joe Dante's The Howling. I'm going to go back to Joe Dante here towards the end because he loves Easter eggs.
Yes.
In The Howling, almost every character is named after a director or producer or creator of a werewolf movie of the past. George Wagner, William Neal, awesome. Terry Fisher, Freddie Francis, that's Sam awesome. Newfield, Earl C. Kenton. All he names these characters, Charles Barton. They're all named, their characters are named after these people who were, have a place in werewolf cinema history. That is great. Wonderful no Easter egg.
Where did you learn this, Joseph?
Just by their names, literally.
Oh, I was not paying attention. That's awesome.
I'm sitting in the theater watching The Howling in the 80s, and of course, I grew up watching old black and white Universal, and I, you know, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and I know that Will Neal directed it, and when the name comes up, or Earl C. Kenton, I'm like, where do I know that name from? They actually say the name, Dr. George Wagner. Well, I know he directed The Wolfman. Wait a minute. Hey, you know, I'm piecing them together. That was a thrill for me because nobody else knew. Nobody, I was convinced that nobody in the world, I was the smartest monster kid ever. But I was like, how could nobody see this? This is brilliant, you know? And I love Joe Dante for things like that. And for my own part, my favorite you know, Joe Dante bit is his relationship with Dick Miller.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, Dick Miller, he's still alive. He's that guy. He's the actor that you see in all movies and you go, it's him again. I know that guy. I guess best known, I want to say for Mr. Futterman from Gremlins. He played Mr. Futterman. But he's in almost all Joe Dante movies. Back in 1950,
even Joe Dante sequences, as in The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Yeah.
In 1959, he played, he was in a Roger Corman 1-hour little cheapy movie called A Bucket of Blood. Mm-hmm. And Dick Miller played a character called Walter Paisley, who was a busboy at a coffee shop, an arty coffee shop. And in the film, Walter Paisley becomes this famous artist by killing things and covering them in clay. He starts with a cat. He moves on to a neighbor woman, and he's killing people, covering them in clay, and putting them on display as his art. And he becomes this famous, well-known artist in the beatnik art world, anyway. Walter Paisley. So it wasn't until Hollywood Boulevard, Joe Dante in 1976, he was an assistant to Corman back in the day. He made his film debut with Hollywood Boulevard, and he casts Dick Miller as a character named Walter Paisley. Okay, fair enough. And Dick Miller's like, who am I playing? You're Walter Paisley. Again? Yeah, just it's the name. It's only the name. The Howling, Joe Dante casts Dick Miller as the bookstore owner named Walter Paisley. Twilight Zone, the movie, he makes a very brief appearance it's a kind of a blink and you miss it. It's a Good Life sequence. Right. He's a diner. He works at a diner. His name is Walter Paisley.
Walter, yeah.
Chopping Mall. He's the night watchman at Chopping Mall named Walter Paisley. Night of the Creeps. He pops up again as a cop named Walter Paisley. And in Rebel Highway.
I'm seeing a pattern here.
Yeah. I challenge you guys to just go ahead and check out his IMDb listing, Dick Miller, and just you're going, Walter Paisley, Walter Paisley, Walter Paisley, Walter Paisley. I adore that stuff, man. Yeah. That makes me so happy whenever I see him and I know he's going to be, you know, oh, look, it's Walter Paisley.
It's Walter Paisley.
By the way, so that is an example of Easter eggs that I find, you know, the most amusing, you know.
Yes,
little cameos by other characters within the same universe. Sure, those are fun. But when it's that kind of stuff, when you figure out that, you know, some director named this character after like his mailman, and he's appeared in every single one of his films or that kind of thing. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. I love
those those kind of Easter eggs, especially like, again, pre-digital era, you know, are the ones that that got me looking more closely at what I was watching. And as a kid that wanted to know more about this stuff, I would stay and read the credits, you know, like as soon as I realized, oh, they're trying to talk to me, I started listening. And that was a really cool thing. And I do begrudge just a little bit the, you know, the 12 hours after the movie hits in the cinema CB comic book reader.net or whatever. Yeah, here's the 15 things you missed in the movie. Well, hold on a second. Don't I get a chance to look? You know, come on, man.
Good point. Good point. That's almost a spoiler in itself.
It is a spoiler in itself. You know, I mean, and for a lot of people, you know, the kids, of course, you know, they'll instantly head to YouTube and look. And my thing is no, let's talk about what you saw. Maybe we saw different stuff and we can, you know, that's part of the conversation, you know? And I think it's a conversation. I appreciate the fact that there's somebody doing it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, can I have a second to breathe?
No, good point.
Focus
good
my
point.
Eyes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But by the way, another great, I guess cameo, but you know, a Easter egg, like the Tom Hardy thing. One I've always chuckled at and love, but it is Prince as the body in the field in Fargo.
Prince? Like Prince? Prince.
If you go and look at the credits for Fargo, it says body in the field, right? The body that Frances McDormand finds at the very beginning. And next to it, where the credit would be, it has Prince's symbol.
Son of a gun.
The little sigil that he made for himself.
All right. Prince, everyone drink.
Had a cameo as the body in the field.
Wow.
And again, I keep wondering, like, did Prince actually just go out there and decide to lie in a field of snow while the Coen brothers took several shots? I mean, I don't know. But that is, if you look in the credits, it is Prince's sigil that he went by for a while. Next to body in the field in Fargo. And I've gone back and I've looked at that movie and I'm like, there's no way you would ever know that was Prince. She doesn't get near enough to the body to say, hey, yeah, look, that's Prince or whatever. It's just a body. And the fact that either Prince wanted to do it or they were fans of Prince and said, hey, would you do this? I don't know the story, but the fact that he agreed, you know, I'll do that. Yay, Prince is the body in the field.
Well, the Big Chill? Wasn't there a famous actor who played the body at the beginning of the Big Chill too? But
It's
what's his name?
Not William Hurt, not Kevin Kline. It's it was his first role.
He's got no
speaking lines. He literally is the dead friend, and he's not in a flashback either.
You never see him.
We never see his face. I mean, they show you putting him in his funeral garb, but Kevin Kline. Was it the Kevin Kline? No,
Kevin Kline's in the movie. It's Kevin Costner.
Costner. All right, yeah. So you talked about Joe Dante. I need to talk about John Landis for just a second.
Yes.
He has had now mostly this is Landis talking to himself, which would explain his son Max and his predilection for speaking out loud. But Landis likes to put the movie See You Next Wednesday in everything that he does. And I think it's awesome that he does this because there's this wonderful intersection in the Twilight Zone that deals with not just See You Next Wednesday or rather, Lieutenant Niedermeyer from Animal House.
Yes.
Right. But at the end of Animal House, you know, we see Douglas Niedermeyer carried off. And of course, the caption is killed in Vietnam by his own troops. And then in his episode, the unfortunately fated episode of The Twilight Zone, they can't believe actually they left this in. Our bigot, Bill,
Vic Morrow, yeah.
Yes, played by Vic Morrow, is in Vietnam. You know, nobody sees him as Vic Morrow. They see him as the ethnicity, of course. And so there's a scene where, a company of American soldiers is high on, marijuana and walking through the jungle. And they hear him splashing around, and everybody stops and crouches and assumes the defensive stance. And there's a beat, and you hear one guy go, "I told you guys we shouldn't have killed Lieutenant Niedermeyer." And then he goes, "Hey, it's me." And they start shooting. And of course, it cuts to a different thing. Well, yes. I thought that was a very deep cut to put in there. But in Michael Jackson's Thriller, as Michael is watching himself be the werewolf in the movie, a reference to I Was a Teenage Werewolf, of course. Of course, as a kid, we all laughed that I'm not like other guys, but what are you going to do? As they're leaving the theater, you can hear the audio continue to play, and somebody says there's a message on the ground, and he says, "What does it say?" And you hear the guy go, "See you next Wednesday." Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you start looking, it's everywhere. It's either a poster or it's mm-hmm. a line of dialogue or whatever.
It's
the name of the porn movie in American Werewolf in London, which nice. Which is awesome. You know, and of course, the porn movie itself is just, you know, totally ridiculous. But anyways, it is a wonderful game to play for those of you who are still actually interested in John Landis's career as a kid, you know, not knowing, you know, now I look back and go, oh, there's a lot of this stuff I wish I could take back. But as a kid, it was very informative to me. And I thought that was marvelous, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, we love that as cinephiles, we love that kind of stuff. And especially when, you know, people point out one that we had no clue, like, really? That's in there. Then of course, you know, you immediately go and either look it up or see if you can spot it. But no, I love when they put Easter eggs in there. By the way, another one in the collector that you mentioned, Joseph.
Yeah.
They have the astronaut dog. What was his name?
Cosmo.
Yeah. He's in there. He's in one of the which I love stuff like that. You know. And again, so Howard the Duck, I would not say that's an Easter egg just because it's clearly Howard the Duck. There's no. Yeah. You don't have to look for it. You don't have to figure it out. You know, did you catch Howard the Duck? Yes. We all saw Howard the Duck.
Right. But the Slither Slugs.
Exactly.
You have to know what you're looking for. Yeah.
That's an Easter egg. You know, Pac-Man on the screen. That's an Easter egg.
Well, the Cabin in the Woods. One of my favorite recent horror flicks. I say recent. It's been longer than I'd want to admit. But that thing is chock full of Easter eggs. I mean, there's, and Joss Whedon's didn't direct it, but he certainly was one of the producers and the writers. And when you see, spoiler alert, guys, when you see all the cubes and all the creatures that are ready for their chance, one of them is one of the Reavers from Firefly, the Firefly mythology. It's a Reaver in one of the boxes that's ready to be released, you know? I mean,
Well, and also... the game Left 4 Dead, if you were a fan of Left 4 Dead, which I was, and I played both the first and the second one, they have the creatures from Left 4 Dead amongst the many. There's the scene where they're in the little glass case and we're pulling back as suddenly seeing all the different monsters. Yeah. They have the Crying Witch. They have I think it's called the Bloater, the Hunter. They have all of the big villains from Left 4 Dead in the little holding cell. So I thought that was a lot of fun as well.
Gotta love it. Yeah. Good stuff, man.
I love it. Easter, man. What a great time. Well, folks, we invite you to keep the conversation going. If you have favorite Easter eggs that you want to share with us and that we did not talk about, of course, we only have, you know, a certain amount of time here at the lounge before Maximilian throws us out. So, share it with us. Go into our Facebook page, enter into the Lobot Lounge, and let's keep this conversation going. We'd love to hear from you. The Gentlemen Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron DiArrive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material provided by, we're not going to tell you, it's an Easter egg, music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs, promotional material, logos, and the Gentlemen Nerds mascot created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, who is, yes, an Easter egg himself, and our special guest bartender was Walter Paisley. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer and the man we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron DiArrive. The Gentleman Nerd's attorney is Dr. Gonzo, and Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. And yes, that's an Easter egg as well. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher DiArrive. Please join us in the Lobot Lounge when we next we open. And always remember, tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. Final words, gentlemen. Mark.
Hey, everybody have a great Easter. Eat some chocolate, get all ripped up, and see if you can find a couple of Easter eggs we were talking about. They're great movies.
Aaron?
Just want to reiterate the folks we really, really need ideas for topics for upcoming shows. Feel free to drop us a line at the Lobot Lounge on Facebook or on our website. Throw anything out, anything that you would like for us to talk about, where it's all fair game. Give us your suggestions and we will gladly pick them for upcoming shows.
I'm Joseph Fotino, reminding you all once again, Red Skull.
Okay, now I need to go and rewatch The Howling. I haven't thought about that movie in 20 years.
We just saw it not too long ago, just because my wife loves that film, and it's one of the werewolves that just terrifies her. The Eddie Quist werewolf, when he toys with her and just so slowly lifts her up off the ground, and she's kicking her little feet there in the air, and he's just having a good time. He's not in a rush. He slowly bares his teeth. He leads almost like a lover, leans in to get her, and it's just it's such a good movie.
Yeah, yeah. And the scene where he picks the folder out of her hand.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the scene.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, no, that.